Welcome to TWiL, the Week in Health Law, the podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. We're recording this episode on September 3rd, 2015. I'm Nicholas Terry, law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis. My co-host is...
Frank Pasquale, law professor at the Carey School of Law at the University of Maryland.
And Frank, today we welcome Ryan Abbott, who's professor of law at Southwestern Law School and an assistant professor of medicine at the Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. Professor Abbott teaches in both the healthcare and intellectual property areas. A warm welcome, Ryan.
Well, thank you for having me.
So we pride ourselves at TWiL at confronting some knotty problems, and today, with Ryan's help, we're going to look at some decisions that may end up severely curtailing the government's power to regulate prescription drugs. But I wanted to start today with a quick trip around some of the federal courts of appeal to pick up on a few oddities that have been left behind in previous shows, and also move on to something completely new. First to the 11th Circuit and the Walschlager case, the Docs and Glocks, or if you prefer, the Florida gag rule case about doctors asking awkward questions about guns and ammunition. The ABA has now joined the ranks of those calling for an on-bank review, saying, quote, "The decision incorrectly upholds a restriction on truthful speech under the guise of regulating the medical profession." So apparently there are about a dozen states considering a similar legislation, and I think of particular relevance to the discussion we're going to be having with Ryan, certainly I think it would be interesting to see a fresh look at that case and maybe a ruling that protected speech is in fact a two-way street. Now a couple of cases that should bring some cheer to the Federal Trade Commission. First, the Third Circuit, and actually this is something I missed a couple of months ago. The issue is not new to TWiL. Frank, you probably will remember, I think it was when Nathan Cortez was on, we discussed the mole app cases.
Oh, yes.
Yes, that the FTC brought. These were mobile apps that the FTC went after as being deceptive for suggesting they could detect early-stage cancer. Ryan, you're a physician as well as a lawyer, and obviously you know that you can easily diagnose cancer with a cell phone camera. So it was quite an ordinary case because it was an extraordinary exaggeration. But the interesting part of the case was the standard that FTC applied. And they applied a really quite high standards of substantiation for the claims. They said that a vendor, a developer such as this, had to come forward with competent and reliable scientific evidence to substantiate that the representation is true and required blinded human clinical testing. Now, you may remember from previous discussions that that sparked quite a strong dissent from Commissioner Olhausen, but a very similar approach was taken by the FTC in POM Wonderful. And I don't know if you remember whether you remember this case. POM claimed that consumption of pomegranate-based products could treat, prevent, or reduce the risk of heart disease, prostate cancer, and erectile dysfunction. And the FTC again took a fairly high substantiation standard, saying that randomized and controlled HCTs, human clinical trials, were required to adequately substantiate claims that the pomegranate-based products could do any of these things. Now, what I'd missed was that the D.C. Circuit, a couple of months back, had denied an on-bank rehearing in the case. So POM, at least in the D.C. Circuit, is now a done deal. While I was there, I reread the case, and I think I also missed the final part of the opinion, which is relevant to some of the stuff we're going to be talking about today, Ryan, because POM also claimed that their First Amendment rights were interfered with by the commission's injunction. And the court applied Central Hudson and said that most of the order satisfied strict scrutiny. Although POM did win a minor victory because it looked like the FTC had overreached with an order requiring two randomized clinical trials in all settings without regard to context. And finally, in this little survey to the Third Circuit, you may remember the LabMD case that the FTC brought, and the interesting part for healthcare lawyers with regard to that case was that the FTC asserted it had jurisdiction even over HIPAA-covered entities, and that security or privacy breaches, therefore, could come under Section 5A of the FTCA, and the fact that they were also covered entities did not enter into the matter. In that case, the agency also argued that they could bring an action for unreasonably poor security or privacy under the unfair prong of Section 5A. Now, most of these cases, traditionally at least, have been brought under the deceptive prong, because what happens is these folks put out a privacy policy and then go ahead and fail it. But this was brought as well under the unfair prong. And that issue is very similar to the one that was raised in the new case at the Third Circuit, which was just decided, FTC against Wyndham Worldwide Corporation. Now, this has been in the press enough that you probably know some of the background. This is a hotel and timeshare conglomerate that was hacked three times. About 600,000 customers' credit card data are exposed. Reports of almost $11 million in fraudulent charges, etc., etc. So rather like LabMD, Wyndham seems to have decided to go to the mat on this case and pushed a motion to dismiss all the way through the district court and then on to the Third Circuit. The Third Circuit just ruled in favor of the FTC and said that failing to provide reasonable and appropriate security for customer data could well be, quote, unfair, as argued by the FTC. It also found no merit in Wyndham's argument that it was entitled to know in advance with ascertainable certainty the cybersecurity standards by which FTC expected it to conform. FTC was absolutely delighted, I'm sure, but industry representatives reacted somewhat negatively. One quote I saw, "We're concerned that this decision will exacerbate the unfortunate trend over the last 10 years of ad hoc litigation and over-regulation when it comes to cybersecurity." The over-regulation piece does raise my eyebrows, since I read last week in Computer World that more than 80% of healthcare IT leaders have said that their systems have been compromised relatively recently. So Wyndham strikes me as a massive blow in favor of healthcare data privacy and security, even when the data custodian lies outside the HIPAA-protected zone. And so I think it is of a great importance for our domain. And I wondered whether you had thoughts on that, either of you.
I agree with you, Nick. I think that that is a very important case. There's a lot of admin law in it to be unpacked as well, which I look forward to doing later this term. But in terms of the merits and the substance, one thing that I wanted to put out there as a response to the criticism of the FTC here is, you know, there were some folks who said, wait a second, the FTC is trying to get away with something here. They're trying to give out guidelines. They're not really making strict rules. And this sort of claim goes back to even a case called FTC versus Ford, where allegedly, thanks to the vagueness of the unfairness authority, one court did say that the Federal Trade Commission had to make rules before they actually enforced the statute with respect to unfairness. But it's good to see that misfire, and it's commonly thought of as a misfire as a matter of administrative law, being rolled back. And it's good to see the courts validating what I think has been a very flexible approach by the FTC. I know that, you know, very smart privacy lawyers like Jerry Stegmaier have testified before Congress to say, what about fair notice? Do businesses have fair notice? But I think the court in Wyndham made relatively short notice of that, or short work of that type of claim, by saying, look, there's some basic cost-benefit analysis that you could have done here to make this type of interpretation of the statute by the FTC reasonably foreseeable, especially given the repeated breaches at issue in Wyndham.
Ryan, now let's go east to the Second Circuit and the very recent Ameren off-label use case. To a large extent, Ameren builds or purports to build on a Second Circuit opinion, Coronia. So I wondered, to help our listeners out, if maybe you could start there.
Sure. Well, Coronia was a Second Circuit case in 2012. It was the first time that the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act's misbranding provisions were challenged under the First Amendment. And so this had to do with a case regarding off-label promotion by pharmaceutical companies. And going back even a little bit further, when the Food and Drug Administration approves a drug for a new use, it's approved under a pretty strict set of parameters. So certain populations, like adults, for certain conditions, like very high levels of triglycerides, certain dosing regimens, perhaps. But once a drug is approved, physicians can, for the most part, prescribe it however they want. But when they're prescribing it in ways that haven't been approved, that's called off-label use. And estimates vary about the extent of off-label use, but it's relatively common. Perhaps a fifth or a quarter of all prescriptions are off-label, and much more in certain specialty areas like pediatrics or oncology. And the FDA has historically taken a pretty strong stance about regulating speech over off-label use by pharmaceutical companies, where they have attempted to prevent pharmaceutical companies from engaging even in truthful and non-misleading statements about off-label use. And they've historically had great success enforcing actions on that basis or under the False Claims Act. In 2012, even, there were GSK had $1 billion settlement regarding off-label promotion. Abbott in that same year had a $500 million settlement, no relation to me. But Coronia was a pharma rep who was hired by Orphan Medical, now part of Jazz Pharmaceuticals, to promote Xyrem, which was an anti-narcolepsy drug. And he was caught on tape to individuals working for the government promoting it for various other indications, or even for a 14-year-old when there was a black box warning, which is the FDA basically saying, really don't do this, and the black box warning said don't prescribe under 14. But whereas the other two individuals they went after settled, he asserted a First Amendment right to be making truthful and non-misleading statements, and three judges in a majority opinion, 2-1 at the Second Circuit, held that in fact the FDA could not prosecute criminally truthful and non-misleading comments under the FDCA. So basically, the second court looked at the government prosecuting pharmaceutical manufacturers and the representatives under Central Hudson, which is used as an intermediate form of scrutiny for commercial speech, and it's a four-part test. First, is the speech legitimate and is truthful and non-misleading? Second, does the government's interest in restricting the speech advance a compelling government interest? Does it concern a substantial government interest? Third, does the regulation in question advance that government interest? And fourth, is it narrowly tailored? And the court here found that the speech in Coronia was truthful and non-misleading, that restricting speech in this context was a substantial government interest, but that that the actual regulations in case didn't advance that interest because restricting truthful speech about off-label use was paternalistic and actually prevented doctors from having information. And then finally they ruled that it also wasn't narrowly tailored. So when this came out, drug promotion is a big deal. The industry spends about $30 billion a year promoting medications, both on and off label. About $24 billion of that goes toward physicians. Drug promotion is very effective. And again, some of the big settlements in recent years about illegal off-label promotion just go to show kind of what powerful incentives exist in the industry to engage in this sort of promotion. So when this came out, there were all sorts of opinions that this was really a landmark ruling. It was going to completely change the way the FDA regulated in this space. Hasn't happened yet. The FDA didn't seek en banc review or cert, and a few big settlements have happened even since that ruling. In part, that may have been because those had been under negotiation for a very long time, and big companies like Amgen or GSK or Abbott may be willing to settle these things for them relatively cheaply without risking, felony convictions and exclusion from government programs. So the next case that has really come along like this has been Amarin, which was just decided last month in the district court, Judge Paul Engelmayer. And he, interpreting this case under Coronia, ruled that Amarin is allowed to promote its drug Vascepa, which is an omega-3 product, and to essentially engage in any amount of truthful and non-misleading speech on off-label use it pleases, and that statements that the company had proposed are truthful and non-misleading.
You know, I think that was a very good summary of the Coronia situation and, that being extended to Amarin. I guess one thing that I just want to throw into our discussion from the get-go is, you know, clearly you look back to the classic First Amendment jurisprudence and scholarship on that by Robert Post, by Schauer, on coverage of the First Amendment, boundaries of the First Amendment. And when they were writing back in the 90s and early 2000s, and they write still today on these issues, they warned that a very expansive First Amendment could essentially eviscerate large swathes of the regulatory state, ranging from things like what the SEC does with respect to disclosures and finance to labor relations laws. The NLRB is constantly telling employers and the unions what they can and cannot say. And FDA being a very clear example of regulating an information environment. And what I'm wondering, Ryan, is did you see any sort of limiting principles in these cases? Like, for example, in the Sorrell opinion, there were some very clear limiting principles, or at least examples given by Justice Kennedy in that opinion, where he said, you know, this is not meant to go after HIPAA. And I'm wondering, were in either Coronia or Amarin, were there efforts by the court or by amicus briefs or other experts saying, this is not meant to decimate what the FDA does, we're just limiting it to this particular situation?
Well, actually, yes. So one of the things the FDA advanced in oral argument and in their brief was really that Coronia was fact-specific. So it had to do with some very sort of circumstance-specific instructions that the jury was given in that criminal case. And basically they were arguing that, oh, well, Coronia really only applies to Coronia. And so, of course, we still get to regulate truthful and non-misleading speech because it's damaging when pharmaceutical companies engage in it regarding off-label use. And, you know, the district court judge in Amarin said, well, I reject that reading. So he interpreted Amarin to have a broad scope, still limited to FDA regulation of off-label use. But I do agree that it is potentially concerning that this could be, and you identified a number of the areas, really extended very broadly, particularly Sorrell, which says, you know, not only does commercial speech get, you know, analysis under Central Hudson, but if you're engaging in content-based and speaker-based discrimination, then really even heightened scrutiny applies.
Right, and this is one of these areas where, I mean, I'm just trying to game out exactly how far this goes, and I'm wondering, you know, what some of the leading thinkers are going to put forward as a limiting principle, because, and I will also say that, you know, unless Nick wants to talk more about the First Amendment, perhaps we could get a bit more into the article you wrote with Ian Ayers and your ongoing work about improving the information environment about pharmaceuticals, because it could be that that's essentially where we're going. I mean, Jane Bambauer, who's been very active in promoting the idea of data as speech, has put forward a view that essentially, you know, has said, if the government wants to improve the information environment around drugs, the answer is going to be, for the future, more speech rather than trying to limit or alter the messages of the pharmaceutical companies. Do you think that there is real hope there in terms of improving the information environment in a way that could really inform doctors and the public? Or might you be closer to one of our other twilled guests, Micah Berman, who has argued that, you know, given the incredible emotional power of many advertisements and the money behind them, that this effort to improve the information environment by creating more speech will be about as successful as efforts to, you know, encourage people to speak more in a post-Citizens United environment where there might be, say, a lot of money on one side, not much on another.
I think that some of the work that I've done with Ian and elsewhere about improving how we regulate using information, it doesn't need to be an either or. So you know, we may be headed to a space where the FDA can no longer restrict this kind of information. But even if we're not, I still think that there's a much more important role for the government to be playing in disseminating information, whether, you know, it's in Vermont encountering physician detailing, or whether it's the FDA doing its own sort of dissemination of information. You know, the FDA said in its briefs in Ameren that, you know, the reason we want to restrict truthful speech is that we want companies like Ameren to have to submit a supplemental new drug application. In other words, we don't want them going out and saying, look, there's some evidence that this drug works for this other condition. We want them to submit everything they have for us to review, and failure to do that undermines the drug approval process. But I think even in addition to that, you know, there's a lot of potential harm from people taking off-label drugs where it's not evidence-based, because really all drugs have harmful side effects, and patients shouldn't be exposing themselves to risk without evidence the drug will be effective. It is often, in the big data era, enormously complicated for a practicing physician to review, and possibly impossible for a practicing physician to review all of the data surrounding an off-label use. Physicians just may not have access to that information. The information may not exist. They may not have the time or skill set needed to make those judgments. And that's, you know, essentially why we have FDA approval in the first place. You know, Michael Berman, I think, was commenting that in terms of disseminating information, whether in Vermont or the FDA, the government is sort of outgunned. And that's one of the proposals I've kind of played around with, is how we can maybe engage third parties who aren't normally part of the drug regulatory process to play more of a role in this. So in an earlier article, I looked at, you know, for example, insurance companies, and I looked at the case of Vioxx, and company insurers like the VA and Kaiser, you know, have really very large internal research hubs, and they had independently determined that Vioxx presented an unsafe, although that wasn't in an off-label context, that Vioxx really wasn't essentially a safe drug for what it was being used for, and they restricted their own use. I think one of the problems was they really didn't have the incentives to share that information widely enough or quickly enough. And so I've been looking at, you know, incentives we might give to third parties to be involved. I propose something modeled after the Federal Claims Act, a kind of QTAM action where a third party could submit evidence to the FDA regarding a drug, and if it resulted in changing labeling, they could get paid a bounty based on how much Medicare and Medicaid were going to save by altering their prescription practices.
Those all sound like great suggestions, and I really appreciate that article, and I will definitely be putting it up on our show notes.
Ian and I worked on a few different proposals we had for changing the way that the FDA regulates, and one of which was a tiered labeling system. So right now you have, you know, a few stronger measures like REMS. So the FDA can outright dictate who gets to use a drug and where. So patients can be under contracts to do certain things if they're taking drugs. Only certain facilities can use certain drugs. Physicians with special kinds of training. But those are really the exceptions for drugs that potentially have very high risks associated with them. Other than that, you have black box warnings, which again we talked about a little bit earlier. A big black box and a warning that says, really don't do this thing. And then you have lots and lots of other warnings, and drug companies are very happy to put warnings on those labels because it can preempt claims about failure to warn. And Ian and I propose that you really have kind of a more nuanced system where you could have, you know, say red box warnings where prescription for a particular use or in a particular patient population was absolutely prohibited. You could think thalidomide for pregnant women. Thalidomide was a drug used to treat morning sickness that resulted in severe birth defects. You could have black box warning. You could have gray box warnings and other sorts. And you might even tie them into civil life. I say, even just a statement from the FDA saying, we consider the following types of prescribing practices to be evidence of medical negligence. And you could really attempt to leverage some additional systems to get more informational regulation.
To just track back a little bit, Ryan, to the reach of Ameren, and so parenthetically also Coronia, we've talked solely about the impact on the marketing and other activities that pharmaceutical manufacturers get up to with regard to trying to interest doctors to sort of move around the limited regulatory permissions given by the FDA. Do these cases in any way impact direct-to-consumer advertising? Is there anything there that we should be watching out for that falls off these cases?
You know, it's funny you should mention the direct-to-consumer thing, Nick, because I was just speaking with a student today, you know, about behavioral advertising for drugs online. One thing, you know, it's really fascinating that a lot of people have brought up to me in various contexts is, wow, if I'm surfing the web or if I'm on Spotify or something and I see an ad for a medication for bipolar or a medication for depression, etc., does that indicate that there was some sort of targeted behavioral advertising based on a data profile of my IP address or some other data profile of me that was gathered, you know, by a marketer for a pharmaceutical firm or by someone else? And so that made me try to look up, you know, wow, has there ever been, first of all, to think, could there potentially be off-label marketing implications here? Because we all know that a lot of big data is bad data, to borrow a title from Sharona Hoffman's article, and you know, especially in these ad spaces. And so you might wonder, like, well, even if they have some sense of there being a population one can identify as depressed based on big data profiling of their purchasing habits and other commonly available online activity information, there's certainly going to be mistargeting of people who are in no way depressed, you know. Or if you go back to Spotify, people are listening to sad songs, getting certain types of targeting. So after that, I just looked up in a few sources and saw that the FDA, apparently from 2004 to 2013, has very rarely gone after sort of off-label marketing or tried to discourage that in the direct-to-consumer context. I think it was only in perhaps 4% of the cases where there was some sort of discouragement or other effort.
Drug companies aren't allowed to make kind of statements to consumers about off-label use. They can, if someone inquires about it, direct them to a science or a medical officer at the company. But it's interesting, it's kind of like Sorrel, where they were data mining physician habits. Now you could data mining using Spotify patient, you know, behaviors and mental health states. And you could be now, if there are fewer restrictions on misleading or no restrictions on misleading and truthful advertising, I don't see, kind of from a First Amendment perspective, what's to stop them from advertising directly to patients. I mean, I suppose you have a more vulnerable and less sophisticated consumer base, but, you know, that's kind of the argument that the government made as to why we need these restrictions, that physicians aren't sophisticated enough. And I think the Second Circuit and the district court here rejected that and said, well, that's paternalistic, and really there's no harm with more information as long as it's truthful and not misleading.
So just to end, Ryan, and thank you so much for those ideas, to take you back to Caronia, Judge Livingston, the dissent in Caronia, said, quote, "The majority calls into question the very foundations of our century-old system of drug regulation." Two questions to end on. One, is that right? And two, isn't it about time?
Well, the district court judge, when the FDA presented that argument in Ameren, responded that, well, that was the framework that was set up in 1962, and really there's been a sea change in First Amendment law regarding commercial speech. And so really, it sort of has to be viewed under that light. And for that respect, it is indeed time to change this. I think that the FDA has really very good reasons to be concerned about pharmaceutical manufacturer promotion of off-label drug use. It has the potential to have some adverse public health consequences, but I do think that we are trending toward a time when there's a lot less restriction on commercial speech when it's truthful and misleading. And misleading's in the eye of the beholder. I think this has the potential to be, you know, a very contentious area in the next few years with a lot of litigation and a real change in the way that this is done. And, you know, part of that is good. It is empowering consumers in the pharmaceutical industry. But I think it's kind of early to tell how this is going to all play out.
And that was this week's The Week in Health Law. A special thank you to Ryan Abbott, who can be found on Twitter at Dr. Ryan Abbott. Thanks so much for joining us, Ryan.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We post our show notes at twill.com. Also there, you'll see a link to our crowdfunding page if you'd like to support the show. You can contact me on Twitter at Nicholas Terry, NicolasTerry. And Frank, where can you be found?
Frank Pasquale on Twitter, FrankPasquale on Twitter.
Thank you for joining us, and have a legally interesting but healthy week.